Testing, 1, 2, 3, 4, sounds out, looks okay.
Working fine.
This is the,
That's the microphone.
That's the microphone, okay.
Picks up very well, and I think we're all set.
Okay, your nickel.
Okay.
Take your coat off.
I think want I am.
Take your shoes off.
It's a warm day off.
Well, you're smart with short sleeves.
I just grabbed some shirts.
No, those are smart in the summertime. Why people wear long sleeves, I'll never know.
Well, let's begin. I know you were born on November 9th, 1924 in Brooklyn.
Correct.
And you were the youngest of three.
Right.
I read a lot about your father, but could you start by telling me something about your mother?
My mother was born in Eagle River, Wisconsin, one of five. Five children in a little town up in the Northwoods, Wisconsin. It was a lumber town. In fact, later in life, my father bought a place up there. We used to spend summers even as a kid because my mother, I say, was one of five. The eldest two, following tradition of families, went to work at the family store. My grandfather had a, I guess you call it a soft goods store, you know, shoes and dresses and cloth and things like that for this little town up in Eagle River, Wisconsin. The eldest two went to work in the store, and the other three, don't ask me how they did it, the other three went to college.
Hmm.
One uncle was a doctor, one uncle was a dentist. My mother graduated University of Wisconsin and was a school teacher. And she went back to this little town of Eagle River, Wisconsin to teach. It was a one-room schoolhouse. Small. To this day, there's only 1,491 people. When you drive to Eagle River, the sign says 1,491 people. So I don't know how many kids they had in school 50, 60 years ago or more. I'm trying to think. She was born in 1892, so she was teaching. She probably graduated college around... I'm sorry, my father was born in 1892. She was born in 1896. So she probably was graduating from college 1917, around then, and probably taught all grades. She taught 12 grades.
Mm.
She was the only school teacher. It was one-room schoolhouse. And whatever child came in, she taught. She was a math major, but minored in other things. So she used to tell stories when somebody would ask a question, say, in history. She'd always say, that's the head of the class, she just got to wait, we'll cover that next week. And at night she'd go home and study that. So she studied with the students. And so that's her background, was a University of Wisconsin a school teacher. Met my father at a wedding where her roommate from college, she attended the wedding, her roommate from college married at that time my father's boss, who was the chemical salesman. The two of them met at, I'm trying to think of his name, I'll think of it later on. I get old, you start forgetful. They met at the wedding, and 41 days later, my mother and father were married.
Mm.
My father was impetuous, get it done. He was not impatient. So 41 days after they were married. And then, of course, they will cover later on, they moved to New York. But she was from a small town in Wisconsin. A wonderful woman. Loved to fish. Some of the picture down the wall because of the move, but that's her with her fishing guide.
Oh, yeah.
Catching fish in Wisconsin. And those two pictures over there are my grandparents' 50th wedding anniversary in 1929.
Mm.
So that would have, and then it's 1929, covering the five children. He went to work in the store, married them there. And she went to work in the store and married there. He's a doctor, traveled with John Philip Sousa.
Really?
Banned when the flu, the influenza was killing everybody
in
World War I.
Right.
And the books about John Philip Sousa covering that Dr. Frankel was the banned doctor and nobody got sick. He was a dentist out of Milwaukee, he was a doctor, and it was my mother and my father. And all the little kids. So that's
very nice.
Okay.
It goes back a long time.
Yeah, that goes back. Good, that's what history's about.
Yes. Well, you've written in that Newcomen address about your father and how he arrived in this country when he was, what, four?
Right.
I think, something like that. I was curious when he went to work, or he went to school at Armour. That was just a what, the beginning of World War One, sometime in there?
Yeah, he was born 1892, so he was at Armour Tech. For a fact, there's a picture, I think, of him, 1914, as a chemist. So, yeah, it was just before World War One. And remembering that the chemical industry in World War I or before was all German. There was no American chemical industry. You know, the dye stuffs and the pigments and the sophisticated things all came from Germany. We had, of course, sulfur and caustic soda, things like that, but nothing was really sophisticated.
Why did he get that, have that interest in chemistry?
The story he tells, which I believe, he was went into fire protection engineering. He had one arm. You know, he lost his arm. And he went into fire protection engineering, and which was a big thing, fires, the Chicago fire, and chemical industry was nothing. I guess the fire protection was very important. And the first semester in the wintertime, he was climbing, not ladders, but
fire escapes,
and he decided that wasn't for him. And he switched, and I guess that was about the only other thing, or one of the few things that that they offered was chemical engineering, because a poor Russian immigrant with one arm doesn't take chemical engineering in 1914 or whatever he took it. So, but he did, but he switched from fire protection engineering to chemical engineering. It's interesting, Armor Tech became Illinois Tech. My father was on the board of Armor Tech and Illinois Tech. He and a fellow named Harris Perlstein, who had Pabst, was the head of Pabst, was also a graduate. And when the Armor family in the 30s were going broke, couldn't support the school. It was named after the Armors, but they just physically, financially couldn't support it. And my father and Harris Perlstein put together a group of old alumni and picked up and kept that school going. So it was Armor Institute of Technology then, and my father, when he graduated from Armor, continued night school. That was again, and became a lawyer. And went to downtown school, which we still support, Kent College of Law. Kent and Armor, first Armor became Illinois Tech, and Illinois Tech merged Kent in with them as their law school too, so that both his law school and his undergraduate school became part of Illinois Tech. And he was on the Board of Trustees, I guess, almost till he died.
You commented also in that Newcomen address about how well he was able to function with only one arm from a young age.
Amazing.
Was he 7 or 8 when
that
accident happened? And again, going into chemical engineering, working in a laboratory, that must be quite a challenge.
He tells stories of how he did it. He said the best thing ever happened to his mother wouldn't help him. Made him do everything for himself. When he used to doing things for yourself, when you wear shoelaces, I don't. He was lazy. But shoelaces he always wore. He could tie shoelaces and ties, clean fingernails, eat. If you spent 10 minutes with him, I think you'd forget that he didn't have one arm. And the only thing that he needed help on in eating, the only thing that I think he needed help on in anything, he played a good game of golf, he played tennis, he drove cars when the shift was on the floor, you know, and he figured out ways to hold the wheel with his elbow while he did it. The only thing that he really needed help, that killed him, is lobster.
Really?
You really can't eat lobster with one hand. You really can't hold it and do it. So with lobster, he let them take the meat out of the shell. Otherwise, he'd kill you if you went to help him. He developed ways to hold things that he had half an arm, so he could hold things underneath. And of course, then later in life, he developed himself a very lightweight arm himself. Didn't function except the fingers could, he could hold them open so it would hold cards. He was a fine bridge player, so that he could snap them open, put the cards in, and would hold the cards, and he could play bridge. It was just a short, very lightweight, with a glove on it, that made it easier for him.
Do you think that early experience helped his determinism?
Definitely.
Through life?
He was the most determined man I ever knew. He really was. Very bright man.
Do you know why he pursued a law degree after he had his chemistry degree?
I don't know. I guess it was just a habit of work. I remember in those days, today we go and we watch television. I don't think they had radio. I don't think there was radio. I can remember a car radio in 1929 when we'd pull along the side of the road and listen to Eddie Cantor on Sunday night or something like that. But
now, around the First World War, I don't think
people had radio.
No, I think it was commercial radio.
So there was nothing to do at night. You read a paper, you read a book, a family, but there were no diversions. So the school was just sort of a normal way of life, of competing education, continuing. There was no obstacle that he felt he couldn't surmount.
Mm-hmm. Well, you certainly made that point clear when you described the fire that
It's true.
That,
that's a true story. The fellow whose wedding he went to was Max Wallenberg. That was the, his boss. And his wife, I don't know, of course, Mrs. Max Wallenberg. My mother's roommate married my father's boss, Wallenberg, in Chicago.
Now, that was at Dager?
A Dager, yeah.
Yes. Okay. But before that, after he was at, he spent a couple of years at a couple of different places,
right,
before he went after, well, the fire was at, not at Dager, but at...
it was a flour, big flour warehouse.
Yes.
The flour, that's when he was working as a chemist in somebody's little laboratory. It wasn't Dager. And the fire, I told the story, he went to answer the phone. He was a production foreman, chemist, sales, a little bookkeeping too in those days. He answered the phone, and they were, at that time they were using, I guess, buying a carnauba wax, I think it was, some type of wax. And he went to the library there in Chicago and found a formula, blending all it was, a blend of two waxes, so he got some samples. Put the two waxes together to see if they would do it under the Bunsen burner, and when he went to the phone, the wax came over, caught fire, dribbled, caught fire, that redded space, and the big fire was next door with the complete flour warehouse just long.
Did, how long between that and the time he got the job with Dager? Was he unemployed or did he?
They were married. I'm trying to think when they were married. He must have been working for Dager in 1920. They were married in 1920. He graduated school probably around 1914. So he worked, the company was founded in 1920. They were married in 1918. Married in 1918, the company was founded. So he worked for about 4 years for other people, different jobs, and then got married and struck out on his own.
Why going out on his own, and how did he meet the Tumpiers?
I don't know. Through in Chicago, how he met the Tumpiers, through somebody. Tumpiers were two of the three. Ridge, I showed you that picture of the three of them, but all three didn't start at the same time. The company was founded in May of 1920, and my father owning 51%, the two Tumpier, the older two. One was an inside man, a sort of administrator you'd call today, but was a fishing guy, order processing, records, books, salesman, or watching sales expenses. Julius was a great, the older brother, the eldest brother, Julius Tumpier, was a great salesman. I didn't know Julius. He retired before I came to work with the company. But Julius, they say, was one of the greatest salesmen ever alive. So he was the outside man. Day was the inside man. My father was the businessman, I guess, and also covered, Julia, my father covered Akron and the rubber. Got to remember, there was no plastic industry.
Right.
Chicago in those days was tanning, no leather chemicals, ink. There was a lot of printing done in the Midwest. Sears, Roebuck, Catalina, a lot of printing companies there. No rubber. But the products that they jobbed in those days had some application for rubber. Fillers, clays. And very small rubber, some rubber processing, a little belting, some hosing, but rubber was Akron. So my father covered the major accounts in Akron, which were big volume accounts. The Julius Tumpier covered Minnesota and Illinois and I guess Indiana, places like that. So they started the two brothers. How he met them? I guess through people. He had a good friend. If you want to know, we got an old timer I'm going to see in 2 weeks. His name is Jerome Harrison, but he was part of the Tumpier family. He's 82 and retired now. I'm taking him to Las Vegas. I always give him a little vacation now and then. We go personally with another old employee. When I first started with the company, he was very nice to me. I started working in Chicago with Jerome Harrison. Jerome Harrison's brother, or cousin, was a doctor. I. Harrison Tumpier. Don't ask me. And I. Harrison Tumpier was also a stockholder, original stockholder of the company. Original of the Tumpiers, 49% was split up, and Dr. Tumpier had some stock. So I got a feeling that my father knew I. Harrison Tumpier, socially probably met him when he was working. And he had some cousins. He wasn't a brother of the two Tumpier brothers, or the three Tumpier brothers, and they met. And Julius was, I don't know if Julius had sold before, but my father had some capital he'd saved. In those days, people saved. They didn't go to Las Vegas and spend. So They saved up, the original capital, I think, was $50,000, I think they put it to the
really?
Start. The Tumpier brothers, the two of them, and the doctor, who was I. Harrison Tumpier, collected $24,000 or whatever, $24,500. My father saved $25,000 or borrowed, if he did. And that was the original capitalization company.
That's a good sum of money for that time.
Yeah. I guess as a jobber, yeah, they bought carloads and sold LKL.
Okay.
So it isn't like today you represent, they're true representatives. They don't have to take any credit risk, carry inventory, just to know a rep. But in those days, they were true jobbers. They bought that. I'm aware they bought out a warehouse. I got some pictures here of some really old trucks. I mean, beautiful pictures of real old trucks with the name Wishton Tumpier on the old chain driven trucks. They had a deliverer in the area. So they had to buy a truck. They had to get a warehouse. And when they bought, they had to pay their bills. I guess my father was always also a very shrewd or a very smart financial man. He always believed in getting money when you didn't need it, because when you do need it, you may not get it. We've always, as a company, inventory money. We borrowed a couple of years ago $150 million at 5.5%. Didn't need it. We had money in the balance sheet. That's why I think we grew, because money was never a problem in our company. Projects always were approved. Since I've been with the company, there's nothing that's never been not approved. We always have, if you look at our balance sheets, you'll always see $150 million of cash or equivalents. Now we're down. We just bought the DeSoto chemical operation in DeSoto for $65 million, and last year I bought in $24 million of our stock. And they said, well, we had authorization to buy in $100 million. And they said, why didn't you do it? I said, when we were working on the DeSoto, it was a bidding game. I didn't know if we were going to buy it or not, so we followed the process of buying in our stock. But the minute it was a done deal, or almost a done deal with DeSoto, quit buying the stock. Bought DeSoto instead, but used up almost $100 million. 65 and 24. And I still, even to this day, I'm still looking as of today. Although our balance sheet shows $84 million cash at the end of March. Cash. I'm not talking inventory, I'm talking cash. We're still, in the finance committee meeting next week, I feel we should go and get another $100 million. Get it while you can get it. Interest rates are down, stock prices are up. So that's where we built the company. We built the company by internal growth and acquisitions, and always had the money. So I said, it was a lot of money in 1920, yeah. When it was soundly financed, you always want to pay the bills. So that the $50,000, when you buy a truck and you get an office and you start buying a carload of this and a carload of that and bring them into the warehouse, you're going to pay the bill. Now you're going to slowly sell them out. That's why he always was, me too, but it was crazy on inventory. Crazy, I think, in the company to keep inventories down. Because he went through not having the money or needing the money to buy the next girl.
How many employees did he have when they started out?
Glad you asked. I've been going through some of his old papers here. Lots of, in those days, of course, now we don't save anything. The government, my secretary won't let me save nothing. If I confirm something to you, she may throw everything away. Every year, she, this is 91, she brought in 89 files were finished. I got here a list of every employee when they went public. They went public in 1958. Again, in his files I found them. And it's interesting, I knew everybody by name.
Mm.
Almost everybody by first name. I never counted them, but in 1958, and by then we had, look at the annual report, had factories having this and that. Well, it was show location. We didn't have that many people.
What are you going to do to preserve these papers?
I give off and on to our people here for our archives.
Okay, so you do have a company archive.
Yeah.
That's good.
Stuff like this. Everybody went to war in the World War, in World War II. He wrote to us, sent everybody a present, told everybody their job was held for them, and the answers here are really great. Everyone, almost everyone answered in 1944, 45, longhand or V-mail or anything else. Somewhere in Italy, so interesting. He was very considerate. Let me get this down. He was all company. He never drew more than $48,000 life on this company.
My gosh.
shows pensions right here. And I just have it. It must be over here. I must have kept it out.
Here it is.
Here is the founder of the company. Very generous. Never had much money.
And
1957, Republican 1958.
His pension benefits,
$500 a month.
And was a consultant, $10,000 a year. That's all he wanted.
He was the boss. I'm sorry. He was the boss.
That's amazing.
That isn't today, is it?
Yeah.
That's even with me, including me, that's the same today.
Because that's before inflation, but in 58.
Still, I mean, considering everything, that's still not...
Pension was 500 and 10,000 he took.
Here's the, you say, how many employees do they have? I don't know, but I would say that they had no more than, they had the one office. That the two tuppiers of my father were three. I'm sure there must have been a girl's four. Maybe a bookkeeper, maybe not an accountant, maybe six or seven people they started with. I'm sure if I know my father, he just started with the two tuppiers himself. And then they worked their way into a secretary. 1958. If you want any copies of any of this, I'd be happy to make them.
Oh, yes, if you don't mind.
But 1958, August 20th. Sales office, Akron. Plan office, Boston. These are sales office. Ripon plant up on the fourth floor of Bush Terminal here. This industrial. I don't know if you know what Bush Terminal
is. Yes.
Making steerings, metallic subs. The warehouse for the jobbing items. We did our own trucking. Chicago office, which were sales and some purchasing. By then we had the Chicago plant. Chicago plants. We had Chicago plant in 58. Chicago plant research, Houston office, Lawrenceville was an asphalt plant, number two. Glenwood was a, California was a little small plant we bought from, which a paint company were three. Perth Amboy was a location of four. And that's it. I mean, a little plant we started in Canada, steering plant. So we have four locations. And if you want copies, I'm happy to make. You want.
Yes, I'd like a copy of that sheet.
Okay.
Would you mind a copy of
this? No, no problem. This is the agreement, I guess. This is the agreement. What are you going to get?
It's absolutely amazing.
No, I take it back. See, he wasn't stupid. Let's see. Now, this was, he was frugal. This was 1957, but... His compensation for the service agreed to be rendered. Whitco paid Mr. Wish the sum of $20,000 per annum for the remainder of his life, effective January 1st, 1962. So the first 5 years, he took $10,000 a year, but then he covered himself in case of inflation, quarterly installments for the rest of his life. So he did. He took $10,020 after 5 years.
In 62, he would have been 70.
He was born 1892. Yeah, 62, he would have been. 62 and 70, you know. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, I'll get me copies of those.
What was the question? How many employees we got?
Well, that's...
How many we had? It's funny, I knew everybody here personally. I can add these up.
When we went public, this is the day we went public, and we went public in May of 58, and these were all the employees of the company. And now I'd worked in every location, practically. All the sales offices worked for me. I was in charge of the chemicals division, which was the Chicago and Perth Amboy plant. And I knew everybody by first name, the whole company.
Mm-hmm. By comparison, what is the company today?
Too many.
Okay.
My father used to go to, as he got older, it was hard for him to comprehend. You know, it's one thing running a business, another thing building. And when you build, you need sometimes some long-range planning. We'd go have a Christmas party. In those days, we were fairly small. They look around, and once we bought companies, we bought Argus and Brooklyn, and we brought them over to the park. You look around and say, who are all these people? And I said, well, those are from Argus, and that's from people coming in from Sonneborn. We bought Sonneborn in 1960, big company, Sonneborn Chemical Refining. And he said, do they all work for the company? I said, they all work for the company. But he said, do me a favor, fire one. He said, can't the company get along with one less person? I said, you're right. It was always, you know, one less person. And I said, you know what, you're building the future. If things get tough, we will. But I said, right now, I'm going to keep building for the future. But he could never end it with a lot of people, a lot of non-productive people. salespeople he loved. Whenever sales things were tough, he offered the sales department, anybody who wears out shoe leather, he said, get holes in your shoes, I'll buy you new shoes. To this day, I have bets in the company with shoes. But he loved salespeople. He just couldn't understand, as business got more complex, the problems of the departments that we have here today, you know, like 21 people in the safety, health, and environmental, and the legal departments. He never had a lawyer. You had a lawyer, you picked up the phone, you called your friend the lawyer. Now we got a patent lawyer, and I'm just talking here, we got an ecology lawyer. It's tough today. It really is for a small business. It's very difficult for small business to survive in this environment. You got to be big to be able to afford the staff that you got to have to exist, to stay alive. I don't know how a small $30, $40, $50 million sales company survives today with the amount of people that they need that are not productive. So how many people we had then? I'd say 6 in the beginning. We went public in 1950. I'll give you a copy of this and you can count them yourself.
Okay, sure.
But again, I say there's every one of these, you got a story. Every one. My God, there's a name I forgot. She was my secretary, Lady Grouse.
Okay.
I'm sure that's 33 years ago. 1957. Yeah, 33 years ago I went public.
Well, let's go back to the early days again.
Okay.
As I understand it, your father came to New York because one of the Tempeers didn't like it here and they switched?
Yeah, but he felt it was growing, New York was growing. Back after World War I, New York industries changed, New York Population Center. I guess paint was very big in New York. I remember they were jobbers, distributors. And as they got a line, you just couldn't buy a car on the county, it had to be a bonafide distributor of warehousing, so you wouldn't be double competition. Remember before I mentioned Chicago, I talked of tanning, I talked of some rubber. Paint was very ink I talked about, but not paint. For some reason, New York was the paint area. As they developed, got other lines that more towards paint, magnesium carbonate, some colors, and siennas, numbers, and blank fix and things that went into paint. Those days, lithopone, before titanium dioxide was around, lithopone and stuff. Then they felt New York, he felt New York. And one of the top beers came here, Julius, I think. He wasn't here long, and he just didn't like New York. He liked there were Chicago people, brothers and family. So my father said, if you don't want to do it, I will. And that's when he came here. And I think the year was, they tell me, my brother, I know that my brother and sister were born in Chicago.
Okay.
But I was conceived in Chicago and carried and born in New York. So it must have been in the summer of 1924, he came, because I was born here in New York in 1924 in November. Thank you.